Joining us today on the Culture Catch, filmmaker and humanitarian, Miss Allison Thompson. Next. Today's podcast is sponsored by the Italian retailer Napapiri. For the finest clothes, visit napapiri.com. Joining us today on the Culture Catch, we're very honored to have Miss Allison Thompson. Allison, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me, how did you get involved in this really wonderful and humanitarian project that everyone needs to see?
Well, it's a long story.
We got a lot of time.
Okay. I was sitting at home watching TV, and I saw the planes go into the World Trade Center and raced off down there on my rollerblades with a first aid kit and arrived just after the first tower had gone down and actually ended up treating people and becoming a rescue worker, an unofficial rescue worker, and started a triage center and lived in the streets for 6 days collecting the bodies and everything. And then stayed down there, joined up to the American Red Cross and stayed down there for 9 months as a volunteer. So I sort of got the bug as a volunteer. I learned that when a disaster happens, like, everyone's needed. You know, volunteers, giving out water, giving hugs, whatever. And it's a mess. It's not as organized as you think it is. So when the 2004 tsunami hit, I was watching it on TV and watching Anderson Cooper on CNN and just crawling around my apartment and going, I've got to go help, when they were showing hundreds of thousands of bodies on the ground. So I thought, you know, I know a little bit of first aid, just a little bit of common sense. So I said I was going, and then I just didn't have any money, so called up some friends and tried to get a frequent flyer ticket, and it just happened. And then jumped on a plane and went over there, not really with a plan, but I had my shots in my arm and I had first aid kit and I was ready to go. So that's how it sort of came about.
You make it sound so matter of fact, but you told me earlier that your parents were missionaries. So you were used to seeing impoverished conditions in third world countries. You know reality about how the rest of the world lives. Most Americans are clueless about this, or most civilized countries.
Yeah, I grew up as a missionary's child, and I was dragged into every jungle out there growing up. I didn't really appreciate it growing up because, you know, we go out to have a shower, and you've got 20 frogs jumping around you and bugs, and it's very, very bad conditions. But it opened my eyes up to the world, and I think growing up a missionary's child, I was used to working, you know, being in third worlds and feeling comfortable there.
Yeah. So to just drop your entire life, and you've been in New York how many years prior to this?
Oh, I've been in New York about 18 years, but right. On and off, going to Africa and going off somewhere.
Doing relief help?
No, really, a whole number of things. I was doing investment banking. I was teaching mathematics at a university. I was doing lots of different things. And then one day I said, I'm going to go to film school. So I just quit everything, quit salary, and went off to NYU film school to learn how to do filmmaking.
Because that's what you do after all those other things.
Yeah.
Your creative muse had to be answered.
Yeah.
So when you got into the spirit of altruism in helping, 9/11, I think, was such a galvanizing experience. I think we've lost sight of it, too, us New Yorkers who lived through that. And you've kind of become numbed. You numb yourself, I guess, maybe, to handle with the post-traumatic stress of it. Some people, I think, maybe become more enriched by the experiences, and like you were. You decided, look, I can take that energy that I learned from post-New York tragedy into the tsunami. Yes, no, maybe?
Oh, you want me to answer that? like, when something happens like September 11th, it is so, so bad. But so much good does come out of it. Like the whole world came together and everyone rushed down there, and lawyers and bankers and plumbers and every walk of life just working together as one, all races together, because there was just one goal to like help, you know. And it was an amazing feeling. And that's what happens when these disasters happen. Just the good comes out in mankind, and it's just, the word is, there is hope for humanity, because when this shit goes down, people really just pull themselves together and they forget about all their selfishness and all the shit in the world, and they just go to help. And it's an amazing experience. Sometimes people find themselves for the first time in their life in a situation like that. You know, we grow up in these air-conditioned malls and worlds, and we travel around into apartments and shops, but you get over there in one of these disaster situations, you know, it's just your common sense and all the basic raw life that comes to life, and you feel really good.
Well, you really did a full tour of duty, though. You went there for an extended period of time, came back to the States, and then went back a second and third time. Is that correct?
Yeah. You know, in the tsunami, there was thousands and thousands of miles of damage. So there wasn't enough government, NGOs, there's not enough help. And even though we were looking at after our village, we were seeing people starving like miles down the road in every direction. But we couldn't just leave them in this condition. Like, we had to keep going back until it was finished. You know, my mother taught me to just always follow through on everything you do. And you can't walk away from something like that and go and sit in a Chinese restaurant and have a glass of wine. You know that they're suffering. So we just had to go back until it was finished.
But did you have the inclination right out of the gate to say, I want to film as I'm going? Was that afterthought? Because here, you said you went to film school.
Yeah. No, absolutely not. This was not a film mission.
No,
like,
no.
I went to film school, and I'd made a feature, and I was wanting to continue on that road. I didn't even think about making a documentary. But when I was going to the tsunami, you know, like I do wherever I go, I take my little tiny video camera. So I thought, I'll take a couple of shots. I'm going for 2 weeks, come back and have a fundraiser and show people. But it just didn't work out that way. I got there and we were running a field hospital with 1,000 patients a day in very serious, serious conditions. So I just, every now and then, I just hand the camera around to people for maybe 10 minutes a day. You know, just, here, I'm too busy. But then after a few months were going on and we decided to stay, I was like, you know what, just keep shooting, just capture this. You know, even every night before we go to sleep, I tried to get the feelings of the volunteers, and I didn't really know if anything was going to happen about it, but it was a really good way of therapy, just to talk into the camera, get it all out, and then the next day was a new day.
And you did something very wonderful. You hired one of the locals to be your camera person.
Yeah, like a local came through about 2 or 3 months into the experience, and he said, you know, do you want me to shoot some stuff each day, you know? And I said, yeah, you know, we'll pay you room and board or whatever it is, and just shoot stuff whenever you want. So he'd wander through like an hour or so a day, and he'd shoot. And he wasn't really experienced shooter, but it actually worked out really good.
Well, it really shows the humanitarian aspects. It's really, I mean, when you have an amateur shooting, there's no setup. You know, you're seeing real life unfold, and I think that's part of the charm of your documentary. It's none of this scripted stuff where, you know, oh, well, the lighting wasn't right. We have to make the suffering look more real.
And actually, as he shoots, because he's basically a basic learner, so the refugee camp gets, as it starts to heal and rebuilds, he gets better.
Right.
So, he's shooting into the sun, he's zooming in and out, and then, he gets better as the camp gets better. So it works. It's so real and so natural. There's nothing forced or planned about it.
Now, you take us through the journey of the camp, the refugee camp, and how that started. You land in Sri Lanka with your boy. You convince your boyfriend to go with you.
Yeah. My boyfriend was a producer, and he'd never really done anything else, but he'd always wanted to volunteer, but he just didn't know how that step to do it. Like, a lot of people write checks, but they don't really know how to go and do it, and that's what the film shows also. It's like some sort of roadmap in how to do it. And so I dragged him. I said, I'm going to go, you know, if you're not coming, you can come with me, but I'm going anyway. So he goes, I thought about it. And he says, oh, yeah, I'll come, you know. So we, I end up taking off in the air before him because the ticket came through, and somehow he got a ticket and had to be at the airport. But so we just landed at the main. We just knew we had to get to the main city, and we had one night booked in a hotel. And that's all we knew. We just knew we could rent a car and just start driving down to the disaster. And that's where we met two other people in the team that are in the film. At the airport, and they said, hey, why don't you join us?
So, this, you know, everyone loves the guy Donnie, the Australian guy, you know, he's just got the heart. I mean, you all have incredible hearts and you're altruistic, but Donnie's like this bigger than life character, and the villagers nickname him the shepherd. He walks around with his staff, and you can just see his emotions just melt on screen to the point where he physically gets ill because of it. You know, he's just let himself out. He's been bloodletting the entire time, basically, right?
Yeah.
And he has to go away to recharge before he can come back in. Tell me about him. What a character, huh?
Donnie. I meet him at the carousel at the airport, and he's like, I'm on a mission from God. Oh, that's my type of guy. But that was the only religion we ever got out of him, you know, except when he was like running into furniture and he'd swear his head off, you know. But Donnie was such a good, good guy. It's an example of like the biggest guy and the most loudest guy. And when the tsunami happened, these people were traumatized. So it was the first time they'd laughed. And he'd jump out of the van and walk into a village and like, how you going, mateys? And they would just laugh their heads off. And it was a healing thing, you know. And he was no fear. And he kept us laughing the whole time. Because when a disaster and all this shit goes down, it's, you know, it's so sad, but you got to keep your sense of humor about you. And we would just laugh our heads off. You know, we'd ask him about his special moment for the day, and he'd be like, oh, I don't know about today, but I'm going to have a special moment with myself later on tonight in bed. And just, we were just cracking up, you know.
So he offered the levity through the tragedy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but it's also an example in the film of, it's not so much being the biggest and the loudest and the most physically fit going to help. It's more so about your heart and your strong heart and that, because he's also the first one to fall.
Mm.
So he starts off as the protagonist and then he falls, and then actually the most quietest.
He gets really sick, doesn't he?
Yeah, he gets really sick because he was starting at 5 o'clock in the morning. He was so gung-ho to get this place rebuilt, you know, as an ex-army engineer. But he would go all day in the hot sun, and he'd come back in the afternoon, like 8 or 9 at night, and have a few beers at the hotel. But you know, he was dehydrated. He was exhausted, you know, and it was just time for him to go when it was time for him to go.
Bruce.
Oh.
And it's interesting how you he's kind of like in the shadows of the documentary. Doesn't want to be. Yeah. He's a very gentle soul. You know, you can see he's a very deep thinker. And you kind of, interestingly enough, you edit him into that space in a way. You don't really see his personality till the very end. And it's a little ray of light that you see pop out of him, and you get his entire story in that moment.
Yeah, Bruce kept us very balanced. He was he's a Buddhist, for a start, and very calm and collected and full of karma and wise words. And he only really speaks when he has something to say. And so in the film, he's the voice of reason. When we all get a little emotional out of hand, he just says something that brings it back into balance. And he was such a good person to have aboard. And in the end, they gave him the people in the village gave him the master of Paralia, the master of the village, because he had
Paralia
a lot of
is
insights.
The name of the village.
Yeah, Paralia is the name of the village, and they gave him a sash that read the master of Paralia, because they understood him. He was quiet, but he got things done. And we had Oscar and Donnie, who were really loud, so he was a really calming influence on everybody.
We come to find out at the end of the credits that Bruce is a gourmet chef, and he's on tour with rock bands all the time and stuff. You don't know any of that, but you see him on occasion cooking up meals for the crew and the volunteers and the villagers and stuff.
Yeah. Bruce is a very humble, quiet person, and you don't really find out much about him, but after extensive hours of talk, then you finally pull it out of him, and he was a gourmet chef, and he's my chef to the rock stars, Pearl Jam, Rolling Stones, U2. He's on tour with them all the time and flying all over the world cooking for them. I guess after years and years and years of heavy drug use and everything with these bands, they're all becoming very organic and herbal, and he cooks for them all and a lot of celebrities.
He probably has the best book of anyone. They probably really, you know, when you're eating, you usually share, right?
Yeah, what was surprising about it, in the very beginning, he cooked a little for us out of the cans, but he didn't really cook the whole time. Being a chef, we were like, when are you going to cook for us? But he was more logistics and everything. But he's just he was a brilliant, brilliant guy.
I think one of the things that really was disturbing about the movie, besides just the lack of basics, is the lack of support from the government. Was it just so devastating they didn't know where to begin? Is that it? I mean, we heard about all the money that was donated, and you very thoroughly point out how most of that money didn't filter through to particularly your village or all the villages combined, I guess, which is a general problem you hear about all the time in these relief efforts, New Orleans being a perfect example right here in America.
Yeah, when a disaster hits, it's so big. And with in Sri Lanka, it was thousands and thousands and thousands of miles of destruction. And it was just, the government were overwhelmed. They just didn't know what to do. They had nothing, no plan in place. It's a third world country. The roads are bad. They don't have the infrastructure to help. So it wasn't, you know, it's hard to blame people. They did this, they did that. But it's really hard to get the military mobilized, everything to get them moving. It's just a mess. All the roads are down, the bridges are down, everything's flooded, there's thousands of bodies. I mean, you think it could be easy, but it's not. And I understand their side of it, the government side of it.
But when you're living through it, you don't understand because you're frustrated. You're like, give us medicine. You said, you know, a lot of the medicine was outdated. Where's the relief help from the people indigenous to that country? How come they're not helping? How come they're not volunteering? Or were they?
No, I didn't understand why we weren't getting any help. And you know, you could hear stories on the radio how the aid was flooding in, but it was backed up at the airports, and there just was no help anywhere. I don't understand it. Like, there's even NGOs in the country for 20, 30 years with warehouses and things from International Red Cross, World Vision, everybody. But just, where were they? I don't understand that. We had thousands and thousands that were relying on us every day, and there's four of us, you know, like, where is everybody? I struggled with that for a long time, and even with the money issue, and I still struggle with the money issue of what happened to it and where is it, because I still don't know, and I interviewed everybody about it.
Some Swiss bank account that's gathering interest.
Yeah, well, we know that hundreds of thousands of millions are sitting in bank accounts around the world and gaining hundreds of thousands of interest. And after a year, you can actually take it out and use it for other disasters and other causes. And so when this disaster hit, it was one of the biggest disasters of all time. And I know even individual companies raise money within their own companies. So for the first time, they'd never done that. And it's still sitting in their bank accounts. I found someone a few years ago, a major bank in America, they said, oh, we just don't know where to send it to. So they've raised it, but they really don't know how to get it to and who to get it to. So.
And then some of the governments may or may not be corrupt, so you don't know if it filters down after it hits. I mean, we hear these stories in Africa all the time. You know, who's in charge of the relief aid? And how does the money filter through?
Well, I have lived extensively in third worlds, and they are very corrupt in all levels. And so you've got the corruption part. You've got the part which the money goes through with the major big NGOs. They have to still say someone donates $100, maybe $4 or $5 gets there because they've got to pay for their big buildings and their cars and their expenses and their plane tickets and all the things that are involved with it. So I watched that firsthand because we were staying in $4 a night hotels and every cent was really going to the people. But I watched so much corruption, so much bureaucracy, and everything's just stuck. But what we can do is, as individuals, we can really make a difference. We can help who we can help, and that's the key. That's the message of the film. Like, everybody is needed. You know, they say, all the big organizations say, you have to have a master's degree, and you need all these fancy degrees and things. And no, I'm sorry, you don't need any skills to give out water or give someone a hug. And I totally disagree with all their manuals that ended up coming through in the end.
How about the use of the internet? How galvanizing was that? And I think we overlook that now. I mean, it's democratized information. You know, politicians are using it to great effect. How much did you find that was successful for your efforts?
The internet was the key to a whole operation. When a journalist came through in the early days from England, and he said, I'm going to set you up a website so you can get people to help. And he set up a website, and I just quickly sent him some lines to write on. I'm like, look, this is serious. Just come. Anybody out there, whoever you are. And people just started flooding in. We had a stripper from London and just anybody who was anybody just started turning up at the village. They jumped on a plane, got in some sort of van and arrived. And they said, yeah, we just saw the website and we thought we'd come. And we had people from 20 nations. And that was the key to the village, just volunteers turning up. No rules, no politics, no bureaucracy. Just get your head down and work. And they'd walk in, oh, I don't have any skills. And then they just go out and do whatever you want. And then you see them playing with kids and doing the most amazing stuff. And that's the key to the whole rebuilding the whole village, was the volunteers from the internet.
A typical day, how many volunteers are in the village that are Westerners?
Oh, well, in the early days, obviously it started off 4, and then a few days it would be 6, then it was 8, and then 10, and then it grew. But I guess about 30 or 40 a day when we really started getting running. But over the whole period, about 1,000 came through. You know, some people might just come for 2 days or 4 days or 10 days. Or we had some Emirates pilots that flew in, and they just had their newborns themselves back at home. But they said, no, I couldn't see these people starve, and they just came for like 3 days. You know, whatever they could do, but that really made a difference.
I think it's extraordinary that human beings can look past their soft lives and get down to basics. And like you said, really feel their DNA switched on. Basic life instincts. The basic necessities to help the human race, help human beings. I think we're seeing a groundswell in this in a lot of different areas in life now. We're frustrated by politics. We're frustrated by how slow politicians or our institutions react to things. So we're just taking it upon ourselves. The internet certainly helps that cause. You know, if we have money, even if we don't have money, you guys did it with nothing. And you were able to galvanize. And
yeah, I think it's about the citizens of the world taking back the world. You know, all the wars and disasters and corruption and bureaucracy. It's like, enough. We got to start as individuals, like, going out there, looking after the environment, the earth, everything. It's like, I think the internet brings a real truth, too, because really, from my experience of living in Iran, Iraq, all over the world, our news is not reporting the truth. I can't watch TV, I can't read the papers, because it is not truth anymore. And the truth comes out in the internet and things, but we've got to start questioning everything, because it's not how it's being presented.
Well, Allison, it's also sound bites. You watch TV and it's a sound bite. It's a 3-second sad story with no details as to how it got to that stage. And then the good stories are 2 seconds, but you're absolutely, the internet, you have people on the ground. I think we're going to see a lot more of this groundswell with news gathering by real human beings. Your documentary is a perfect testament of that. You had a rank amateur shoot your documentary for you, and we saw him blossom. It's extraordinary. It tells the most heartfelt story you can see. You couldn't, try to reenact that with a Hollywood budget.
Yeah, I think that there were moments when I was sitting in the editing room and I was watching some of the volunteers talk straight into the camera. I tried to use subjective camera work where they really look at you into the lens so they could really appeal to that audience member like they were the fifth member of the team. And you can't get anything more real than that. It's so real. And they were so unaware of the camera in the sense they were just too tired and to be affected by a camera. They just were just saying how they felt. And you can't reenact that. And even a very big actor recently has come aboard to help the film, and he's like, I've been acting my whole life, but that's the most real thing I've ever seen. I can't be that real because I'm acting, but I'll never be that real, you know. So people have suggested that Hollywood might come on and remake the film and into a big, really big film, and they're asking to, you know. I just don't think you could do it as real as what we have it. It is real.
Yeah, they'd swell the music at the appropriate moments. I wish we could tell them what actor it is, but you guys are, the movie's being brought to Cannes. That's really, it's extraordinary. Think about the journey you went on without any pretense about any of this. You went just with the goodness and the glory in your heart with some other human beings, and what's happened on this path, this journey for you. So last year you guys get in Tribeca. You just finished the movie. After how many, 500 hours to edit down to 90 minutes, if you could. You get critical acclaim, and then what happens? It kind of goes underground, right?
Yeah, we finished the film 3 days before Tribeca was about to start. And I hadn't really processed anything because I'd come straight from the village, straight into the editing room for 14 months, 14-hour day, 7 days a week. Suddenly finished three days before Tribeca, into Tribeca. So much went on, sold-out shows, standing ovations. And then nothing. It was very quiet, and we have one of the biggest sales agent in town. But it's like Miramax and all the big ones, they just love the film, but they're like, we don't know how to market it. You know, we have our big feature films, and there's a certain Hollywood film and a style and the way that has to be. And this is something very different. We're not used to it. We just don't know how to go about it. And so, you know, we went into some other festivals. We went to Sydney Film Festival and a few other ones, and we won some awards and things. But it's still like, how do you get it out there? And it's a message I really want to get out there, but it's like, how do they market it to a mass audience? And that's the question. And then I knew I had to get it to some people who really knew about films and really get it. And we got it to some really big people in Hollywood who aren't the usual Hollywood types, if you can sort of understand what that means. And they got it. And I got a phone call right away and said, the world has to see this film. We have to get this in every theater. This is a message of today, and we have to get this out there no matter what happens. And they really got behind the film, and then it's being picked up from now on. And we are actually going into theaters around July, August, throughout the U.S. But it's a hard question to answer.
Well, how, did you feel any resistance? Maybe if you were a male producer and director of a movie, you would have had more leverage. I know this is sometimes a concern for women in the film industry.
Absolutely not. I don't see myself as a male or female director. I see myself as a director or as a filmmaker or a good filmmaker or whatever the term is, but I never saw myself as female. As a mathematician, I was in a field of surrounded by men my whole life as a mathematician, and I was never really treated any differently, and I haven't been treated any differently in this industry. If you've got something good, then it's good. And a lot of females say to me, oh, yeah, don't you discriminate against? Isn't it hard? Isn't it tough? I'm like, no, well, maybe your stuff wasn't just very good. You know, I think it's an excuse because I've really been treated amazingly. I've only been in the industry about 8 years, but I haven't come across that yet. So it's about the product and it's about the film itself. Sometimes, like when I actually made my first feature, people in Hollywood were sitting watching it and I wasn't out there, and they all turned to each other and they said, oh, you know, who made this film? And I said, oh, it was Alison Thompson. She was the girlfriend of the producer. And that sort of, you know, I started dating him a year after I'd made the film and everything. It was really referring to basically I'd slept with the producer to get the job, and that's not how it was. So.
Labels.
Labels, yeah.
Damaging.
Yeah.
So now everything seems to be on track in a serendipitous kind of fashion, right?
Yeah, everything's on track with the film, and I'm just excited for the world to see it. But the next question is, everyone's saying, like, what are you doing next? And it's like, what do you do next? Like, do I go back to features where it's not real and you're trying to obtain something that's really real? I mean, how much more real can I be? And I'm thinking, like, the new type of films are somehow, even if I take a bunch of the best actors off into some crazy story, but just let the story happen, no script or anything, you know, and then it's still got that box office appeal, but these people are just being in a real situation, being themselves. They're being the most ultimate acting situation you can ever be in. So I don't know. I'm just thinking, what do I do next?
Well, maybe that's an outcry of all of this reality program we've gotten into.
Yeah.
It seems like everything is hyper-reality.
Everything's hyper-reality, but there's so much reality on TV, and people are watching it. Even though we talk so bad about reality shows, people are watching it, okay? And maybe we have to bring that element, take out all the silly games and all the silly stuff that's in those, and just bring the real element of emotion and reality back into it, but not make it silly, make it more real. I don't know. It's just there's something about reality that people want to see.
One of the things that I think is very taxing for art, you always seem to have an ebb and flow in art. You know, the great masters of classical music had their moment, their zenith. Rock and roll had its renaissance in the 60s and 70s. Filmmaking had its zenith in the 70s, although you could argue the blockbuster movie in the 80s and 90s, you know, replaced them. Documentaries have always been considered third class, not even second class, third class citizens. The word documentary was always, too studied, too smart, boring, boring, boring. Now with reality TV, we can get to a point where maybe people are more accepting. You yourself said you cut your movie with a narrative impact, looked at it as a Hollywood movie. Is there hope for the documentary?
There's totally hope for the documentary. And as long as we move forward in that sort of thinking, and not the way we used to cut documentaries, like with acts, three acts, and similar to a feature film. But the thing is, it's real. it's not someone acting. It's real stuff, but it's without the silly games and all the things we see on the reality shows. That's the future of filmmaking.
You know, I think people who are listening to this may say, okay, that's great. You have the spirit of Mother Teresa. You know, you went out there, you did it. Most people are happy to sign the check and send it off to the organization. As you said, you know, maybe 5% of that money filters through, if that. You know, how do people really get into that mindset where they just say, let's go for it. Hmm. Let's go to the next disaster. Let's go to New Orleans. You know, I think one of the things I've spoke to different organizations that are on the ground running like yours, Charity Water and my friend at Goal USA, where, you know, they bypass all the politics of the governments and they just go in like you guys did. And you're on the ground running, you're there, you're just building out the infrastructure, just like you said, just giving someone a hug who's been through such traumatic life. How do you get to that level as an individual? Is it just you're born with it? You're born up a higher level on the ladder of life or something? You vibrate on that level?
This is a really hard question. I mean, everything you've done in your whole life sort of leads to something, but also, just think life, like going to a bar every couple of nights a week and sitting there for 5 hours drinking, isn't that pretty boring after a while? The same old conversations. And I had a whole bunch of friends in the stock market, and so all they could talk about is just the stock market and money. I mean, there's got to be more to life than that. And even like going to help, there's a whole other side of it. Like there's a lot of fun as well. It's not all disaster and sadness. Like you got a whole bunch of really cool people from all over the world playing guitars on a beach at night and hanging out. And there's a whole other side to it. And it feels good. I mean, it really feels good to help people, if it sounds a little egotistic or something. But like you come back and you have this confidence that no therapy could ever give you. Like you're walking down the street and you don't have money for your Con Ed bill and all this stuff. It's a hard day. And then you're like, nah. It's okay, I just saved 50,000 people. It's okay. And you have this deep confidence within, not like saying it out loud to people, but it's hard to explain until you do it, but you just got to do it and you just don't need money or anything else. You just got to say, yeah, I can do it. And let all the other stuff happen just along the road. You don't think you have to have it all planned out and this and this and that. Just trust that you can do it. I mean, if you're a human being that's ever been outside your door, out of your bed, you can do it. I mean, I've seen people do it. So it's just getting that motivation. I don't know. I mean, even if it's just 2 weeks, you don't have to go for a year. 2 weeks or 10 days, it's like any boss in the world is going to let you go, you know, or just go. You know, you come back, you have an eviction notice. Big deal. Like, you work it out. It always works out in the end. You're not going to die, you know. As long as you have a bit of food and a bit of shelter, it's all going to work out. And it always does work out, even though you have all that worry and fear. You just got to take the fear out of the equation.
I guess I don't know what the percentage is of human beings who live in free societies that take so much of our day-to-day existence for granted, but the third world realities are so overshadowing of what we take for granted.
Oh, when I got back out of the tsunami disaster, the headlines were about Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston breaking up. And there's nothing about the real issues of the world. It was all about that. And everyone was complaining in America about this and about that. We have it so good here. You know, I had cold water for years over there. And I got back and we have so much here. And I've really have been to every continent of the world. And we have an amazing country. And we have so much. So just shut up and stop complaining and start giving back a little bit. Because I'm not, you know, I can't listen to you complain anymore.
Tell me about the early warning system that you put into place. So even though you left Sri Lanka, you left with a really wonderful legacy.
Got to the stage where I just had not a single cent left to help them. I mean, I just didn't have anything. I just really couldn't even help them in any way anymore because they needed to be left alone to go back to their lives. But the one thing I could leave them with is some sort of warning system, because every day they would flee into the jungles and be so scared thinking there was another tsunami, because there's no radios and TVs and there's some sort of system in place. So they've lost 8 kids, they got one left, they're going to run inland. So I created a tsunami warning system. It started off just in a simple, in a house upstairs, and it has a speaker system set up throughout the village. And then if there is a warning, we pay... some officers. We've trained some local people into monitoring the ward for earthquakes 24 hours a day, and it's open 24 hours a day. And if there is some sort of warning, a cassette goes on, please move inland until further notice, or if there isn't, it says please remain in your homes. And this has taken away a lot of fear that people can sleep at night. But it's the only tsunami warning system in the country, and suddenly it's growing and growing along the coast, and the speakers are moving. It's protecting hundreds of thousands of people right now, and the place is still very volatile. And every day I've recorded at least 350 earthquakes above 5.5 magnitude, and it's a very, very dangerous situation. The plates are still bad, and the Californian scientists have been exploring the area, and they say there's going to be an even bigger one any day from now to the next 10 years, bigger than before. So we're just preparing for that. We go into all the villages along the coast, and we teach them about disaster preparedness and about how to try to strengthen their homes into two stories and many different things. But it's really about keeping the people safe. And we're still the only one in the country, but I'm still supporting it by myself every month. It only costs about $2,000 to protect the country. But the military, the Navy, everybody calls us, about 250 calls a day saying, is there a tsunami? And we just reassure them there's not, and we give them real facts. But, you know, we just need help because it's hard finding that little bit of extra money to every month to keep it open. We're really, the governments, NGOs, anybody should be supporting it. But they love the idea and everything, but still we're traveling along a little lonely road there.
How did you deal with the language barrier, which I think is always a barrier for most Americans since we only know one language and we're so arrogant to think that everyone else will figure out English?
Well, the biggest problem over there was language and the communications, because there's only one person that spoke English in the whole village. So, and later on we find out she sort of had an agenda, so she wasn't really telling us what they were really saying. But anyway, we were just like, you know, you just make sign language and you just try to work out from emotion. Like when a lady cries after losing eight kids and she's telling you in her language, but you can't understand, but you feel it deep in your soul because it's just, you know, she's in so much pain. But yeah, we got into a lot of trouble with language because we probably would have left a lot earlier if we didn't know what they're really saying. Because in the editing room, like, you know, years later, we were like, they were saying that, you know, and they were talking some pretty heavy stuff against us as well about the white people and stuff. But if we really know what they were saying, I guess it would have been another whole story. So it was good to sort of be a little ignorant and just concentrate on the bigger picture, food, water, shelter, and all the other stuff was just left by the wayside. And it was probably pretty important. But next time, the only thing I would change is really having a good translator from another area, not from that village.
A bipartisan translator.
Yeah, bipartisan translator. Because even our camera guy in the end wasn't telling us what they were saying, and we had some death threats and he'd turn around and tell us something different, and you know, that was a bit of a serious situation.
Man, that's very daunting. Would you have left anyway had you known? Probably not, right?
No, like in the end, you know, you could throw anything at us and we didn't bother us. You know, we were thinking about the bigger picture and we sort of rose to a new level. Like, this is all petty stuff and you can beat me up because your eight kids are dead, but this, it's really, she's just really upset.
Frustrated.
She's not mad
at
me.
Yeah, these human
really.
Beings who are completely at their wits' end. They've completely been traumatized.
Yeah, and they just had nothing and they weren't really, really meaning it against me. And so I just rose above that. At first I took it personally and I cried and I ran off into buildings and have a cry, or just the ego would creep in. But in the end, you just had to wipe your ego and the vanity out of everything and just realize the bigger picture.
What do you want people to walk away with after watching your movie, after listening to this podcast?
I want people to realize that there's a need for everybody in every situation. One person really can make a difference. You don't need education, skills, or anything. That you really just can make a difference, and you just go for it. Just go for it, and you can do it. We'll never know the seeds that are planted with someone who watches this film. Maybe someone will watch it, and years from now, will just go somewhere and save millions of people. You just never know, but just to plant seeds that you're needed. You sitting there in the audience, that you are needed. And just don't rely on the governments and organizations that got it all covered, because they don't have it all covered.
Allison Thompson, The Third Wave. I've watched it four different times now, and it's moving every single time. And I hope anyone who's listening to this has an opportunity to see it, and I hope that the distribution is wide and varied out there in the world of digital media, and that everyone gets to see your movie. Thank you.
No, thank you. One last little thing. Like, you know, like we keep moving on to the next disaster, but everything is still so much need. Like tsunami is still another 20 years of rebuilding, and the Pakistan earthquakes and Katrina and everything. And the thing is that proceeds of this film are also going back to those areas that are forgotten too. So it's not like we're about to make a bunch of money or something.
Incredible documentary. I hope those of you who are listening today have an opportunity to see her movie. It's really, really wonderful experience, and wish you nothing but success for the future. Thanks for being on.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank today's sponsor, Napa Perry, our guest, Miss Allison Thompson. I hope you enjoyed this podcast, and if you'd like to hear more, please visit us at culturecatch.com. Plenty of written reviews and historical audio and video podcasts. And please feel free to leave a comment for us in the iTunes directory. We appreciate your help and your listen. This is Dusty Wright. Converge is the word.